President Biden has officially restored Bears Ears and Grand Staircase Escalante National Monuments to their full original boundaries. You made this monumental win for wilderness possible. More than 3 million acres of stunning red rock cliffs and mesas, slot canyons, and sacred Native American ancestral sites are now protected for years to come, thanks to you. After Trump eviscerated the monuments in 2017, people like you who care about America's Red Rock showed up in force. You came to rallies, you spoke with your elected officials, and you shared the stories only you could tell about why these landscapes matter and need to be preserved. Thanks to your efforts, Bears Ears and Grand Staircase Escalante are restored. Thank you.
Welcome to Wild Utah, the podcast of the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance. I'm Dave Pacheco. Non-motorized or human-powered recreation is growing on public lands throughout the West, with Southern Utah becoming somewhat of a poster child for unsustainable growth and associated impacts to resources, backcountry values, and user experiences. This increase is due to a host of factors, including widespread advertising, Western population expansion, and a renewed interest in public lands, especially during the pandemic. Not surprisingly, these problems are compounded by understaffed and under-resourced federal land management agencies. They are not well equipped to proactively manage for this explosive growth in visitation, so instead, agencies like the Bureau of Land Management tend to operate in a reactionary way. They should be putting effort towards developing landscape-level strategies that will both protect public lands and provide a spectrum of high-quality experiences for a diverse, recreating public. It's SUA's goal to work with the Bureau of Land Management to proactively address non-motorized recreation in a way that's sustainable for wildlife and wild places, while also providing meaningful and positive experiences for public land users. With that in mind, we set out to develop a report synthesizing the scientific research on the impacts of non-motorized recreation on public land resources. Dr. Christopher Mons, a self-proclaimed recreation ecologist, is professor of recreation resources management in the Department of Environment and Society at Utah State University. He's conducted over 30 years of research on national parks and other protected areas worldwide, and is the primary author of this new report, prepared for SUA in late September, titled Outdoor Recreation and Ecological Disturbance. On September 28th, Dr. Mons participated in a webinar with SUA Wildland Director Neil Clark to summarize his findings. In this episode, we bring you highlights from that webinar. Dr. Mons starts out by talking about the broad framework and fundamental principles behind the report.
What I study and what a recreation ecologist studies is how recreation activities act as ecological disturbance agents across generally public lands. And that's where my work is focused: parks, protected areas, any public lands, both here in the US and worldwide. We look at a range of ecosystem properties. My training is really in soil and vegetation ecology, but I've had the opportunity to work on wildlife issues, water quality issues, and so forth. The other aspect of recreation ecology is really looking at how, when environments are disturbed in some way that's obviously from human activities, how that affects the visitor experience. Most visitors to our public lands come from urban environments, and they're trying to engage with nature in a fundamental way. So that aspect of understanding the human dimension and the ecological dimension is oftentimes part of a recreation ecology study. Of course, where we want to go with all of this is to inform managers, to give them the tools to develop sustainable management strategies in dealing with visitors on public land settings. I kind of want to start at the beginning and really talk about some fundamental principles and theory. This is kind of infused throughout the report. It really forms a basis for a lot of the management suggestions that we came up with towards the end of the report. And the first thing I want to introduce is this use disturbance impact theory, which has really been around since about the 70s or 80s when it was first developed by folks like Mike Little and David Cole. In general, the initial use results in the vast majority of disturbance. That disturbance proceeds quite rapidly up to a point where then additional use results in little to no additional impact in that finite area. Basically, what happens here is impact proceeds rapidly, and then those impacts are done. This leads to really two overall generalizations. The first one, again, is that initial use in an undisturbed area results in the vast majority of disturbance. The second being, as use increases, if we can contain use to that same finite area, very little additional disturbance will take place. And that would be the case regardless of the ecosystem type. Now, I want to make a note here, very important. Common language in land management of this idea of dispersed use, in my opinion, is really a misnomer because it's not really dispersed camping or dispersed use. It's really unmanaged or at large. This oftentimes leads to very high levels of disturbance in a lot of areas. So disturbance tends to proliferate in these situations. As one site gets impacted, visitors move on to another location. As one site is filled, visitors take another location. As a consequence, these situations often lead to the most ecological disturbance. Now, if we're in this kind of situation and we can put in some sort of management action and space out use temporally so that visitors can be confined to a few very good, very durable sites, overall impact is generally less. Certain areas are more resistant to visitor disturbance than others, and some sites can actually be highly resistant in certain wildland settings. And so understanding those dynamics is very important. In the same light, activity type, the type of activities that visitors pursue, the take-home lesson from this, of course, is these may all be legitimate uses, but we need to manage them differently and manage the environments that they travel in a different way.
Here, Dr. Mons talks about some of the basic strategies used to manage recreation on our shared public lands.
Some of the easiest data to get on use is from the National Park Service. Looking at that over the last decade or more, many of our national parks in this area have seen quite a bit of growth. And so we're dealing with an incredible period of change in many of our parks and public lands. This is really as a result of many different factors. There's no place distant anymore. If we're looking at some sort of backcountry management situation, for example, hiking management, we can look at a couple of different strategies and then based on our knowledge, discuss what might be some of the limitations and the degree of effectiveness. In an unregulated kind of situation, this is where we would have travel in locations without specific management, without specific trails, without formal designated routes. Well, on the benefits side, this gives visitors an awful lot of choice, and they can select wherever they want to go and that freedom to roam. However, on the flip side, from an ecological disturbance standpoint, this is likely to be very ineffective, particularly in areas that are dominated by very fragile soil crusts. So as a consequence, we likely see large networks of disturbance forming. Let's take this all the way down to a more active management strategy, like a confinement strategy. What do we mean by this? Okay, in a confinement strategy, we would have visitors travel on established routes. And so if visitors are compliant, it's likely to be very effective. And this is a good way to allow some degree of choice, but still a primitive experience. In very high use situations, we're almost forced to go to a designated trail situation. Visitors have less freedom. They're required to travel on those trails. But as a consequence, it's going to be highly effective at containing and confining impacts to a very limited area. It takes the most management, it reduces some choice, but it still can provide a very high quality experience.
In this segment, Dr. Mons addresses the differences between front country and back country recreation management and why it is important to make the distinction.
Oftentimes in management situations, management strategies between the two sometimes get confused. In a front country situation, we're dealing with high use intensities. We oftentimes use facility type solutions to provide a visitor experience and maintain visitor safety. So this might be developing kiosks, restroom areas, developed trails, hardened surfaces, hardened campsites. It's a high degree of regulation, but it's often accompanied by easy access. And we minimize disturbance through active management. In backcountry situations, we're thinking about something different. It's a fundamentally different experience. We expect lower use intensity. We don't expect a lot of facilities. There may be designated trails, but the built environment is oftentimes not used. We expect less regulations, more challenging access, and disturbance is often limited by putting effort into getting visitors to use their best practices, minimum impact, leave no trace type of approaches. Now, when we start mixing and matching, that's when we get difficulties here. So for example, developing new areas that allow for backcountry access oftentimes increases use intensities to locations more than they can handle. We oftentimes see this in parks. We're very good at moving people to new locations and trailheads, but those areas might have low capacity, low ability to maintain and to accommodate visitors in a way that impacts don't proliferate. And I want to leave you with a few thoughts here and allow me to speculate this overall topic of impact, front country, back country, burgeoning nature appreciation and the need for nature experiences. Some data that we have been collecting suggests a couple of interesting things. And again, I'm speculating here, but that is traditional kinds of activities that are more focused on the backcountry wilderness experience seem to be less of a motivation for our newer visitors than some types of motivations like visiting with friends and family and experiencing with friends and family and simply getting outdoor exercise are for the visiting public. So what I'm speculating here is that if this trend continues, we can continue to accommodate this burgeoning recreation use mainly in front country areas, and that visitors will still be quite satisfied and be able to fulfill their motivations and gain those benefits. Again, I'm speculating here, but these are some of the current trends that we're seeing in survey data.
The report concludes with strategies that should be considered, in particular in this region of the Colorado Plateau encompassing the Red Rock Wilderness.
There really is limited, but some high quality research on the Colorado Plateau. However, in order to come up with a wide variety of management strategies, we really had to look broadly at the literature. That literature and the work done on the plateau really suggests that dispersal strategies will likely tend to increase ecological disturbance due to recreation. As a consequence, confinement will help reduce overall impact, and those strategies should be considered in many, many situations that are now seeing high use. Again, speculating here, but this idea of unmanaged experiences may start to be less important to contemporary visitors than it once was. Now, to a certain extent, it's still important for many people. I'm not suggesting by any reason we should get rid of unmanaged experiences, But we ought to think about it that as a management strategy as we move forward.
SUA's Neil Clark asked Dr. Mons to elaborate on the intersection between non-motorized recreational use and access roads and routes, recognizing that recreational users of all types generally need roads and routes to access desired areas, and how management plans, such as the 11 BLM travel management plans currently being written, can be informed by these principles learned in the field of recreation ecology.
That question touches on a lot of the complexities of various environmental regulations, planning processes, et cetera, that our federal agencies go through. I think an important lesson we've learned in recreation ecology on that very issue is when we have a high capacity to deliver people to backcountry locations, and those backcountry locations essentially have a relatively low resilience, low tolerance for visitor use, that's when ecological disturbances can proliferate. And so I think our work from the recreation ecology side can really inform those planning processes, looking at the unintended consequences of developing those access areas and instead using access as a management tool in order to minimize disturbance and maximize visitor experience.
Here, Neil elaborates on the practical side of proactive route management.
We have to acknowledge that the motorized access routes, the travel plans that the agencies are coming up with, are going to have a tremendous effect on use patterns, just as parking lots and trailheads have an effect on use patterns. And what we see often is instead of a proactive landscape level planning for where that use should be occurring, it happens in a reactive sense where the use increases for a host of reasons. It may just be publicity. And then we're in a position where there's a move to develop trailheads and parking lots. And so we really want to see the agencies move to a system where we can try to manage a lot of that use through just smart proactive planning.
In response to a question from a webinar participant, Dr. Mons further detailed the distinction between front country and back country.
So back in the 1970s, a bunch of researchers put together what's called the Recreation Opportunity Spectrum. And it was the first effort to do exactly what you're asking. Essentially, it's a zoning strategy based on some objective criteria to try to develop different zones where certain kinds of situations, certain kinds of environments, certain kinds of visitor experiences can be expected. Different agencies have adopted strategies like this, but the point being is that oftentimes determining those zones, those boundaries, is part of a planning process. It incorporates both the biophysical characteristics of a location, its proximity to roaded areas and developed areas, and then the fundamental attributes of the visitor experience that can be expected there. And so there really isn't kind of a set distance or set buffer, but it's more part of a broader planning process that's accomplished with those multiple factors.
And I would just add for Bureau of Land Management lands in Utah, I mean, SUA has inventoried most of the BLM public lands throughout the state and has America's Red Rock Wilderness Act, which are lands that qualify as wilderness under the Wilderness Act. The BLM also does its own inventories for wilderness quality areas. And so I think on BLM, you do have some metrics to show you what is like true primitive backcountry versus more front country settings. I think if you look at the original 2000 Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument Plan, that's effectively what they did, was managed from areas they determined they called primitive to backcountry to travel and front country. They had a gradient and each one had different management strategies. And I think it was a really smart way to go about planning. And I'd like to see more of that as the agencies start to revise their resource management plans in the future.
Another question centered on the conflicting priorities of providing for an unconfined wilderness recreation experience while attempting to discourage dispersed camping that concentrates use in new sites. It's a natural tension that needs to be addressed.
So there's a number of strategies. You know, our wilderness agencies largely have relied on, to a certain extent, minimum impact education and a well-trained visitor in order to be able to do that. So when we go in the backcountry, we camp in areas where impacts have already formed, right? And as a consequence, we're not increasing that disturbance. How much we can rely on that is always a subject of debate. And as a consequence, many of our more high use areas, like again, referring to national parks, have gone to designated backcountry site situations. Now, I would hate to see that happen everywhere because of the loss of that unconfined experience. But, you know, we need to do some sort of outreach, some sort of management in order to minimize that disturbance. And, you know, right now, I think the most serious issue in this case is really the roaded areas that are seeing a lot of increased use and increased access with camping in association with those roads. And those areas really seem to be seeing quite a bit of increase in disturbance.
Next came a great question about thresholds. How should federal agencies establish thresholds for when recreational pressure gets to the point where they need to move to more of a confinement strategy? Where's the marker set to make those determinations before you end up with a problem?
It's always better to be proactive than reactive. Good management plans will include an indicator and threshold approach. It's one of the fundamentals of planning that we teach, and the interagency visitor use management planning process incorporates that. So some measurable indicator of quality. And then as you measure that indicator, as you approach different thresholds, a suggested management action. We would measure the quality of the resource conditions, the visitor experience. And as we approach those thresholds, it suggests management actions. Now, these things are hard to do. It requires measurement, monitoring, feedbacks into a planning process. It's difficult and time-consuming, but it's a well-accepted strategy. And as much as we can do that, it provides a defensible way for us to implement management actions.
Our webinar concluded with Neil providing a summary and an immediate action you can take to get involved in this issue today.
I also wanted to note that with the release of the report last week, it was also accompanied by a sign-on letter from more than a dozen Utah-based and regional public lands organizations really expressing concern over these increasing impacts and specifically requesting that the Utah Bureau of Land Management establish what we were calling a non-motorized recreation and visitation working group to really look at existing management policies, identify issues and gaps in existing management, and to make recommendations for state-level policies that will address those management problems. So if you want to learn more about the issue and read that letter, I encourage you to visit the recreation page on SUA's website. It's sua.org/recreation. And I will note that at the bottom of that webpage, under the Take Action heading, there's a link to a petition for the public to also ask the Utah BLM to establish this working group. So I would encourage you to take a look at that and check it out. And please sign on if you would like to.
Wild Utah is recorded at SUA's main office in Salt Lake City on equipment purchased through the generosity of our members. SUA is primarily member funded. Over 90% of our revenue comes directly from people who care about protecting Southern Utah's Red Rock Country. We're proud of that because it keeps our voice independent. If you'd like to help protect Wild Utah today, please head to sua.org and click the donate button. We appreciate your support. Wild Utah's theme music, What's Worth, is composed by Moab singer-songwriter Haley Noel Austin. Our interlude music, Chuck's Guitar, is by Larry Pattis. Post-studio editing and production is by Laura Borachevsky. To stay informed about current events at SUA, visit us at sua.org and click on Get Involved to discover how you can join the movement to protect Wild Utah. To receive information and alerts via text message, text the word Utah to 52886. Again, text the word Utah to the number 52886. Follow the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance on Facebook, on Instagram at Protect Wild Utah, and on Twitter at Southern UT Wild. And be sure to subscribe to the Wild Utah podcast on Spotify, iTunes, or your favorite podcast app. Visit SUA.org/podcast for additional ways to subscribe and to access our archive of previous episodes. On behalf of SUA, I'm Dave Pacheco. Thanks for taking the time to listen. We hope you can join us for the next episode of Wild Utah.